when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
And when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. In previous episodes, we've explored different arguments that the American colonists used to justify the rebellion against Great Britain. For example, in our episode on Native American history, we learned that the colonial veterans of the French and Indian War fought at least partly because they wanted to expand settler territory to the west of the Appalachians. When King George released the Royal Proclamation of 1763 restricting that expansion, the veterans viewed this decree as a betrayal. And so we see in the declaration the accusation that King George invited the, quote, merciless Indian savages to rape and pillage and kill settlers, a passage that was included in order to accommodate both anti-Indian and anti-British opinions. Then, in our episode on colonial economics and the British Empire, we learned that business leaders in the Americas, in the Caribbean, in India, and indeed in Britain itself, used free trade arguments to argue against imperial policies restricting commerce with the colonies. This explains the criticism of King George for, quote, cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, as well as other criticism of his intolerable decrees, such as the Stamp Act, the Tea Act, and the Coercive Acts, all of which enraged the colonists even more. In our episode on religion, we learned that some preachers used faith-based arguments to justify the revolution, while others used biblical passages to justify remaining loyal to King George. Furthermore, we learned that criticisms of religions, like Catholicism, were studiously avoided in the text of the Declaration in order to avoid alienating potential revolutionary allies. At the same time, general religious language about the Creator and divine providence and nature's God was included as a nod to Christians. In several episodes, we have touched on the most famous deleted passage from the Declaration, namely Jefferson's condemnation of slavery, which was removed by Congress in order not to alienate the colonies in which slavery was the norm. All of this is to say that Jefferson used a number of different arguments to appeal to a number of different constituencies when he was writing the Declaration. After all, he had to appeal to as many colonists as possible, and the colonists were diverse, socially, economically, religiously, intellectually, and of course, geographically, too. So the key question is this: how did such wildly different people become one people? Well, today we will look at the legal arguments that were used to justify the revolution of the people, the one people, the American people, against the tyranny of King George. And I have two wonderful legal scholars with me who will explain the legal landscape of the people and the American Revolution, Professors Richard Ross and Stephen Wilf. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Richard J. Ross is the David C. Baum Professor of Law and Professor of History at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He is also director of the Symposium on Comparative Early Modern Legal History. He has co-edited the book Legal Pluralism and Empires, 1500 to 1850, as well as Justice in a New World, Negotiating Legal Intelligibility in British, Iberian, and Indigenous America, both published by NYU Press. Stephen Wilf is Anthony J. Smith's Professor of Global Commerce at the University of Connecticut. His research focuses on intellectual property law and legal history. He is the author of Law's Imagined Republic, Popular Politics and Criminal Justice in Revolutionary America, published by Cambridge Press in 2010. So, Richard, why don't you get us started? Why is it so important that we focus on the seemingly unproblematic term, the people, in the Declaration of Independence?
Thank you, Andy. So the term the people occurs 10 times in the Declaration of Independence, including in the first and second and the last paragraph, which are some of the most famous passages in the Declaration. And we want to ask, what sort of political work did the notion of the people do in 1776? What sort of framings and exclusions were necessary for the term to make sense and do its political work? This is a big question with many answers. We are going to come at it from a specific angle. The notion of the people was bound up with the Patriots' view of law. To understand how the people became a concept valuable in political analysis and motivation, we need to first understand how the Patriots deployed law as a tool of analysis and motivation. How did the Whigs use law to mobilize fellow citizens towards rebellion? The American Revolution has long been described as having a particularly legalistic flavor. During the years of conflict between the British ministry and colonists before the Revolution, so in the period 1764 to 1776, patriots fashioned law in innovative ways as a language that could cross geographical and social borders in order to rally citizens to a cause. Whig law had a remarkable capacity to bridge social and geographical distances. This helped make patriot legal appeals into a powerful instrument of revolutionary mobilization. The way they did this helped make the people into a constitutional construct that could overlook racial hierarchies while binding together settlers of different classes, ethnicities, and religions.
Thanks for that great overview, Richard. Stephen, let's turn to you now. And before you get into your response, can you just quickly explain the passage again that you used from the Declaration of Independence and maybe help our audience understand the Whigs?
I actually want to return to the first passage, "When the course of human events." It's such a potent line. We recite it, we forget what it means, we forget all of its potency. But in a sense, what it's suggesting is that the people is constructed by the events. That is, somehow, it's not just simply that this is happening over time. It's that people are constructed by the events that are occurring and almost molded, shaped, fashioned, formed, and that it's not merely transitory, but in the end, a different people will come, one people out of another people. And I think that's an essential feature of that rhetorical flourish at the very beginning of the Declaration of Independence. It's an historical document as well as anything else. The second piece is it becomes necessary to dissolve the political bands. That suggests that we don't have the usual hierarchical structure that we perceive of politically, that is, with a monarch, and then everything devolves from the monarch. It's already suggesting bands, association, and there's something associational, a kind of mutualism that exists across the entire Declaration of Independence. And we'll see that when we discuss the very end, the bracketing of the Declaration of Independence.
Great. And can you just help us define the Whigs?
After the Glorious Revolution of 1688, we can look at politics in England as being largely divided between two groups, Whigs and Tories. The Whigs were identified with the political economy, which was largely based upon expansion of settlement, upon the idea that they can encompass settler consumer power as well as productive power. And they also largely nodded and gestured towards common law. The Tories were more closely associated with the monarch. And increasingly, as we look at the period under Walpole, as the Tories were involved in, as there is a broad centralization of the the legal system under Britain, increasingly we see a focus on statutory power under Parliament and direction by the monarch.
Okay, so somehow this Whig idea of more, you say statutory, that's a legal term. I'm guessing what it means is a law-based rather than a king or queen-based system of justice eventually moves its way to the colonies. Am I on the right track there?
I would argue that Whig is not statute versus the king. It's not statute versus monarch. It's statute versus common law and general tissue of legal thinking that exists in that period.
But your argument will be that the Whigs have a natural association with patriots, so independence and revolution, and the Tory perspective from the point of view of the law is imperial. So it's, how are you to begin to understand?
Yes, let me actually distinguish that a little bit better. So I would say that for the Tories, after the Seven Years' War, after the victory of England in the Seven Years' War in 1763, the French Indian War, after that, there was a question of how to pay for that war, how to organize empire, how to deal with the fruits of victory. And there was a sense, at least for the Tories, that one had to create a better form of governance than existed before the Seven Years' War, and that one had to create a more unified empire, an empire where the pieces, in a sense, served the metropole, served England in a better and more effective way. And partly that's establishing a better system of taxation. Partly, actually, during that period, is to avoid future wars and then to consolidate what one has succeeded in acquiring at this point. And above all, because, again, this is a very familiar resonance in our own time, there was a great concern for public debt. And the Tories were especially concerned with that issue.
Can I just throw in the lead into the American Revolution,
sure.
Not all of these associations may have been in play to the same extent. I think in the lead into the American Revolution, the association of the Tories with the royalist side in conflicts between the royalists and parliamentary understandings of law, the Tories tended to emphasize royalist and prerogative powers more, and the Whigs tended to constrain royalist power and emphasize parliamentary and popular power. And I think that opposition or that set of tendencies was critical in the lead into the revolution.
Thanks. So indeed there was, in some respect, the concept of self-rule and even the idea that one could rebel against a monarch or leader for being unfair predated or was slowly fermenting in the years leading up to the revolution.
I just want to respond to your point about what's emerging. When I read the Declaration of Independence, I'm really struck with how this is almost a part two of the Glorious Revolution. Some of the arguments that Locke makes in 1689, when the two treatises was published, it's an argument for the ability to change government. And remember that you had a Stuart monarchy that existed prior to the Glorious Revolution, and then the Stuart monarchy is overthrown, and the Stadtholder from Holland is brought in to become the King of England. And you had to justify that. And those justifications really, really set the stage. And those are Whig justifications. Those justifications for rebellion is, in a sense, animating the justifications that you have for rebellion in the Declaration of Independence.
Okay, good. So do you want to carry on with the Whig patriot versus Tory imperial perspective?
Well, I was arguing that Tories saw primarily the need to construct a more centralized and organized empire. And this imperial structure was going to be based upon parliamentary supremacy. So this parliament would construct something more definite through statutes, more definite through legislation than existing in a kind of a patchwork system of local assemblies and common law and custom. And that this would really be backed by the notion of royal power as a kind of absolute power, the king acting through the lords, through commons, but largely the king would create a kind of unified force for this very disparate, scattered empire. Really talking about the period, the first really one of the, you know, really a global empire for the first time, what stretches from the Far East all the way to the New World.
All right, great. Richard, now, how would you like to move the story forward?
Yeah, so Stephen has given us some information on the Whig versus Tory constitutional visions. Whigs can also be called the Patriots. And I'd like to ask, how did the Patriots' constitutional vision win over so many thoughtful colonists? We need to discuss the reasons for the effectiveness of their appeal. And I'm going to give the first part of this answer. From the late 17th century forward, the legal system of the colonies became more anglicized, more like England's. The settlers' growing competence in working with a transatlantic constitutional tradition helped the Whigs advance their case. Mounting disputes between competing Whig and Tory constitutional visions in the decade or so before the Revolution placed legal language at the center of pamphlets, orations, and broadsides. Many Whig spokesmen, from John Adams and John Dickinson to Thomas Jefferson, were lawyers, and many of the non-lawyers, such as Samuel Adams and Benjamin Franklin, also proved well-informed about Anglo-American constitutionalism. But how did this happen? If you go back to the 17th century, the colonial court systems were overwhelmingly staffed not by legal professionals, but by laymen. They administered non-technical and discretionary justice and brushed aside inconvenient ordinances. By the late 17th century, we saw commercialization and increasing oversight by the crown. Both of these created pressures for a more lawyerly and formal legal system. London passed navigation acts to regulate trade and also tried to reduce foreign participation in colonial markets and to better collect taxes on trade. The crown began appointing learned lawyers rather than local notables as attorneys general and chief justices. The King's Privy Council began overturning or ordering revisions to colonial statutes and reviewing judicial opinions of the highest colonial courts. As a result of all this, settlers dealing across colonial or international boundaries in trade and land speculation, and colonists trying to engage or resist imperial administrators, were pushed towards using English precedents and procedures as a legal lingua franca. Study and litigation familiarized the colonists with England's legal culture, and this reduced variation in legal ideas and practices among the colonies. The colonies began converging towards the legal standards of the metropolis. Settlers increasingly imported or reprinted English legal texts and sent their sons to study law through apprenticeship or in London at the Inns of Court. Lawyers and educated laypeople paid more attention to English common law in workaday litigation and in political lobbying, and as they did so, they became more adept at constitutional argument. All of this produced over the 18th century a public political culture better able to appreciate the Patriots' sophisticated constitutional arguments beginning 1764 and running through 1776. What we're looking at is a betterment in constitutional competency. And that competency was increasing among the readers of tracts and the audience for orations. Jurors, voters, constables, and assembly representatives were all primed for Whig legal appeals. Now, all of this may have mattered less if the British Empire could have ruthlessly suppressed Whig legal appeals and Whig political organizing in the 1760s and 70s. But for why they couldn't, let me turn back to Stephen.
They couldn't simply because they didn't have the assistance of those settlers, those colonialists, who are operating on the ground. In this highly decentralized system where assemblies are chosen by local citizens, where juries are chosen by local citizens, where judges may not always be subject to the whims of the crown, the very distance of the colonies led to a kind of decentralization, a kind of difficulty enforcing legal norms without the consent of the governed. So when in that second paragraph, we refer to the consent of the governed. The consent of the governed isn't simply a legal abstraction. It's not simply that in order to have a justified government, you need to have the consent of the government. In order to have a working government, one which could enforce the legal norms and hold the tissue of empire together, you needed to have the consent of the government. And that was a peculiarity of the American colonies, where you had a large free settler population.
Yeah, so what you've both been suggesting here is that this Whig legal argument was indeed important and influential. I just kind of want to pin you down on this a little bit more. Given all of the different groups and arguments and constituencies there were back then, you know, obviously slaveholders were thinking that's issue number one for us, potentially religious people of all the various religious groups, you know, legally speaking, the official churches in each colony, for example, would have want to hold on to their privileges being the official church of the particular colony. And others were rebelling against that, like the Catholics, for example, outside of Maryland wouldn't want such a legal environment. Business leaders had their own business reasons. Settlers who wanted to push further west had their own reasons. I'm struggling still to understand to what extent these legal arguments were critical for whom, given all of these interests and constituencies.
Well, I mean, we might step back and ask the question, who's the audience for this document?
Right.
I mean, that's really the first question. We have to ask a couple of very basic document questions. Who's the audience? What is the genre? Does it have any instrumental power as a legal document? Those are three separate inquiries. For the audience, I think it's very clear that this is meant very broadly. It's meant to create what was called a justification for the candid world. Another phrase is the opinions of mankind. They're concerned in the Declaration of Independence from the get-go. And I think that partly this is that there is an extant republic of letters in the North Atlantic. It's among elites. It's among those who clearly can participate in that conversation and quasi-elites. It's not among everyone. It's certainly not among slaves. But there is a need to justify to the broader world. And of course, this has incredibly important ramifications when France actually enters the fray and supports America in the revolution. So this is aimed partly, you know, is aimed partly at Paris, right? And then secondly, it's domestic. It's to try to find as broad of a basket of grievances as possible, what the Declaration of Independence calls a long train of abuses and usurpations. And those grievances actually, they look like a pastiche. They look like a ragtag bundle of grievances. But in fact is, they're broadly from addressing a whole collection of different grievances that different individuals across the colonies might feel, ignoring issues that are controversial, like slavery and religion. There's only one Catholic signator from Maryland for the Declaration of Independence. And so we're going to be very quiet here about, you know, what might be going on in terms of religious toleration. And thirdly, I think that this document is written historically. I suggested that at the beginning, that when in the course of human events really means that this document is written for the ages, and that they intended to write an historical document of some sort that might be read later and serve as a general weather vane, in a sense, a lodestar for where the country might go. That's at least how Jefferson sees it when he describes the purpose of the Declaration of Independence a few weeks before his death.
Richard, did you want to weigh in?
I think that for people unfamiliar with the political appeals leading up to the revolution, it is startling to see how legalistic much of the literature was. So from the Stamp Act crisis in 1764-75 through the Declaration of Independence, there's what historians call a search for constitutional principles. And so at the town level, at the colony level, in pamphlets, orations, even in street level action, there's this attempt to define what are the colonies' customary rights of self-government? What is an appropriate mode of taxation? This becomes incredibly legalistic when you have in your mind the word revolution, and then you look at these political appeals, the legalistic flavor really stands out.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important point to make that, in fact, it seems like from what you're saying, the colonists did need permission. I guess today we call it a permission structure to say that, yeah, these revolutionary feelings we're having are based in something concrete, right? Not just hatred of the king or this and that. There's some sort of real legal basis for what we're trying to do. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, not until really 1774 to 76 would anything, quote, revolutionary be on their minds. For the first decade, 1764 to 74, what they think they're doing is petitioning, resisting, right? But resisting within a shared constitutional structure that was supposed to bring the British back to right governance from their errors and missteps. It's not a revolutionary moment for the first 10 years. It only becomes so at the end.
And indeed, through the start of conflict with the Olive Branch petition, there is some suggestion that full rebellion could have been avoided. But that's another story. Let's move back to the legal story now, please. Are we back now to Stephen, who wants to talk a little bit about Ireland?
I will. I just want to make a point about audience. There's a sense of injury. I think about the line towards the end of the Declaration of Independence. We have not been wanting attention to our British brethren. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. This is a family romance. This is betrayal. So yes, it's very much about law, and it's about restoring, and it's a restorative vision of constitutional rights for a very, very long time. But during that period when they were seeking the restoration of those constitutional rights, the breach that occurs when their fellow subjects to the king, we're not yet at citizens, we're at subjects to the king, the fellow subjects to the king in Britain are deaf to their voice of justice and that wonderful word, consanguinity, the assumption of kinship. Back to Ireland. Americans are very aware of the Irish story. Henry VIII, in 1542, upgrades Ireland from a lordship to a full kingdom. He's declared king. He creates a parliament of Ireland that meets that year. And he attempts to create a more, over time, there's more and more of a centralized structure that exists in Ireland. There is legislation such as the plantations involving land confiscation. There is martial law, there's the penal law, which drive Catholicism underground. There are all kinds of particularly Irish disabilities that are really quite stunning to anyone who would watch this from somewhere else. For example, Irish Catholics are not allowed to have firearms. They're not allowed to have a horse worth more than £5, because that, of course, can be used for some kind of martial purpose. The churches have to be made of wood. Religion is practiced largely privately if you're Catholic. There's oaths of supremacy. There's a lot of crown direct power that exists in Ireland. Now, you could distinguish between Ireland and the American mainland colonies by saying that first, there was always this fear that Ireland, which was so close to England, would become a staging ground by continental powers, by Catholic continental powers, for the taking of England, for an invasion of England. But secondly, you could also say that the difference in Ireland, where Ireland has a large Catholic population, which is restive and unhappy with their British overlords, that this doesn't exist in the American colonies. So we can just distinguish the kind of legal system necessary to rule that land as opposed to rule the mainland American colonies. But the fact is that this model of centralized control in the Celtic fringe in Ireland really tells you that the Americans had real reasons for real fears about the nature of what a centralized imperium could look like.
Really interesting. I never quite made that connection. I think it's really interesting. Richard?
Let me just add something else about Ireland. You know, In that centralized system, the dominant figure was the Lord Lieutenant, who coordinated a Protestant minority dominating a Catholic majority. And the king directly or through the Lord Lieutenant appointed justices of the peace and sheriffs. They were able to handpick reliable Protestants for juries. This enabled them to control local law and local government in a way that was just not possible in the British colonies, where local notables were the backbone of legal decision making, which is one of the reasons why the British Empire is unable to suppress patriot argumentation and street action in the colonies as they could in Ireland. But let us expand the comparative framework beyond Ireland to encompass Spanish America. And this is going to reveal another set of reasons for the potency of the Whig legal vision. And it gives us a way to think about the Whig notion of the people. At the heart of patriot law was a central idea. Each colony's charter, customs, and historical experiences created the privileges and expectations of a colonial constitution, and that constitution represented and preserved the rights of an underlying people. Patriots insisted that this impressive extent of self-government in American colonies, with the assembly at the center, secured individual liberties and the rights of Englishmen. In the decade leading up to the Declaration of Independence, Whigs adopted the colony as polity and its constituent people as the key units of their political analysis. The rights of each colony and the rights of the people stood as a barrier against the overreaching of Crown and Parliament and against the potentially arbitrary pressure of imperial sovereignty imposed from London. And the more one reads patriot writings, the more familiar this framework becomes. Hence the value of comparing our revolution to the independence movements in Spanish America in the first three decades of the 19th century. This change in perspective invites us to look at Whig constitutionalism with fresh eyes. We then see that its leading units of analysis, the colony as polity and the people, are in no way obvious. And they actually require a whole lot of exclusion and construction. So in Spanish America, the first thing we want to notice is what we'll call the corporatist organization of the place. Political voice and legal relationships in Spanish America were corporatist insofar as they focused on groups and corporations who were considered the composite elements of society. These included cities, bishops and cathedral chapters, universities, the military, merchant and mining organizations, craft guilds. All of these corporations had wide latitude to govern their members and subordinates. And the corporate organizations spoke for the groups they represented in negotiations with higher authorities. The king, meanwhile, guaranteed the corporation's place within the social order and kept them within bounds. All the members of these corporations, the soldiers, the clerics, the miners, the merchants, they all claimed customs and jurisdictional privileges that were called fueros. And these fueros, in some instances, allowed them to move their disputes from regular courts to their own tribunal. The most numerous and perhaps important corporate group were native peoples, and the empire went so far as to recognize a republic of Indians, a República de Indios, which enjoyed legal, political, and cultural protections that were different than the Republic of the Spaniards. So this corporatist organization becomes very important when Napoleon Bonaparte invades Spain in 1808 and exiles King Ferdinand VII and puts his own brother Joseph on the throne. The Spanish regard him as a usurper, and royal government in Spanish America starts to break down. But who now is to exercise legitimate authority in Spanish America? Everyone believes power devolves, but to whom? Urban councils claimed it, so did viceroys, so did provincial tribunals called audiencias. And those who pursued power appealed to corporate interests and recruited leaders from them, even if the claim to power nominally rested on the people. So let me give you an example. In 1808, the Captain General of Venezuela, contemplated appointing a junta, a council, and the city leaders of Caracas recommended 18 members for this junta, and they said, what we need to do is represent all the different corporations. So we should have a representative, one for the military, one for merchants, one for planters, one for priests, one for lawyers, and on, oh, and one for the people. Okay. Well, how different was the Whig constitutional vision? It emphasized colonies as polities, colonies that represented an underlying people. This was an unusual framework in early modern politics, because group-based and hierarchically graded rights and obligations were the norm. In Spanish America, the taxes you paid or the tribunal you went to depended on which corporation you were in. Or were you an average settler or maybe a merchant, a miner, a soldier, an Indian? In British America, what helped the Whigs talk about a people was the relatively low level of corporatism in the colonies. Sure, there are a few corporations here or there, a few businesses and charitable and religious organizations, handful of colleges and cities with royal charters. But the colonies were not organized around respecting corporate, legal, and political voices, nor were they organized around group-based jurisdictional privileges, as in Spanish America. Colonial politics represented persons, not corporations, and the colonies were not riven by the privileges and exemptions of miners and clerics and guilds and universities and soldiers and so on. Therefore, it became easier to believe that an accounting of the settlers' rights could be done at the level of the colony with scant attention to its subordinate components. The primacy of the colony in revolutionary politics further supported its position as the basic unit of analysis in Whig law. Political appeals commonly emerged from or referenced the colonies. So you would have documents going to London from this colony or that colony. Organized resistance to the British was often organized by colonial assemblies. The Continental Congress represented colonies. And when possible, patriots after 1776 took over colonial governments, maintaining institutional continuity by preserving the assembly. So what we had then was an emphasis on the colony rather than smaller units like counties or towns, or larger units like regions. This is all very familiar to us, but in Spanish America, you lacked an obvious focal point like the colony and its assembly. So when the revolution comes or the independence movements come, everyone disputes about the proper jurisdictional level for organizing power and declaring legal principles. After 1810, the territories once governed by imperial viceroys or audiencias sometimes underwent decomposition. Interior provinces and smaller cities appointed their own councils and refused to accept the lead of principal cities like Buenos Aires and Caracas. Or military conquerors like Simon Bolivar combined localities into new larger configurations that didn't align with the old imperial units. Well, all of this British America avoided. It argued over the proper rights of the colonists, but not over the centrality of the colony as the primary political unit of analysis. As I mentioned, a colony's rights and expectations protected the people, which was a stylized and complex construct for the Whigs. On the ground, already existing conflicts in colonial society, religious conflicts, social, economic, all of this shaped political allegiances in the decade before the revolution. But the Whigs could better bring their legal vision to bear if they could array the socially diverse, shifting patriot coalitions under the heading of the people. But here we run into a problem. Whig elites wanted to portray the people as a homogeneous entity, but at the same time, they wanted to insist upon significant inequalities and exclusions among the actual residents of a colony. Anglo-American Whig political theory customarily presented the people as an undifferentiated body, It wasn't uniform in wealth and status, but it was united in preserving its liberties. This stylized, unified people served as a counterweight to rulers who were always assumed to be eager to expand their powers. Treating the people as a homogeneous body allowed Whig elites to speak in its name. But in practice, only propertied white men, a minority of settlers, enjoyed the full range of privileges, from trial by jury and due process protections to voting for representatives in lawmaking bodies. Most residents, whom elites deemed dependent or subordinate, enjoyed only some of these entitlements. Women, non-Protestants, aliens who weren't naturalized, free blacks, men with too little property, they all commonly lacked the right to vote or to serve on juries. So, here's the problem for the Whigs. They have to manage a tension within the concept of the people. A tension between the hierarchies and exclusions that elites expected as part of their social privilege on one hand, and on the other, the supposed homogeneity that made the people a compelling construct in constitutional argument. While this tension couldn't be fully resolved, it needed to be mediated. Anglo-American Whig writers insisted that the legitimacy of popular resistance to government overreaching increased the more groups and classes participated in that resistance. Legitimacy, in other words, went up as social consensus went up, which meant social fissures weakened the concept of the people as a counterweight to rulers. The challenge for Whig politicians in a divided and hierarchical society was, how do you rally contending groups and non-elites to stand as part of a unified people against the British ministry? What's interesting is how the Patriots tried to manage this challenge and why it wasn't worse. Historians have recounted instances where Whigs worked to make the politically relevant people more inclusive. So Patriots in the cities in New York, Boston, Charleston, they all created meetings that brought together people lacking the right to vote. These meetings included women, slaves, minors. This expanded the array of residents who counted in political deliberations and helped reduce the tensions built into the people. But you know, the strains could have been worse, as they were in other New World revolutions. Examining Spanish America suggests some of the ways the Whigs were fortunate in British America. Because in Spanish America, newly arrived Spaniards, called Peninsulares, competed for offices and honors with the Creoles born in the New World. This provoked resentment on both sides. And after the breakdown of royal authority in Spanish America, both the Peninsulares and the Creoles led coups against each other and against officials deemed too sympathetic to their adversaries. This didn't happen in British North America. There wasn't organized opposition by recent immigrants against the old-timer Creoles, which was fortunate because in the 1760s and 70s, we saw a surge of immigration from England and among the Scots and Protestant Irish. Whigs were spared this immigrant corporate interest that could fracture the people, just as they were also largely spared the idea of corporatist fueros, which broke the people into subgroups contending for special treatment in the legal order. Yes, but what about racial subordination? The stark hierarchies produced by the limitations or denials of rights to blacks and Indians surely presented a problem for the Whig notion of a people. And Whig elites were more than ready to accept the notion of a rights-bearing people that allowed the elites to deny privileges to free blacks and Indians who didn't have, obviously, the civic privileges enjoyed by whites. The question is, what let the Whigs get away with this? Well, part of the answer was that blacks and Indians were helpful but not essential as an audience for revolutionary mobilization. Patriots could talk about and talk against blacks and Indians more than appeal to them because of their limited importance in revolutionary politics and military campaigns. Yes, there were hundreds of native warriors who fought with the Patriots. though more typically temporizing Indians fought with the British, whom they distrusted a bit less. And yes, there were free blacks who joined the Continental Army in their own right or as substitutes for whites. And the British Army lured tens of thousands of slaves to them with promises of freedom. But by the time recapture was done and death by disease was done, not all that many free blacks, now free, avoided labor and actually entered combat. We're again talking about a small number, maybe 4,000 blacks served with General Cornwallis on the British side. For all the hardships endured, African Americans in the contending armies, like Indian warriors on the frontier, were not decisive in the battles that decided the war, nor were they significant in the political balance between Whigs and Tories. How different was Spanish America? In many of the battles in the Spanish America independence movements, Indians, blacks, and people of mixed race, called castas, were the majority of the contending forces. So I'll give you one example. The Crown's troops in Venezuela in 1818 had 3,000 Europeans alongside 10,000 Indians, blacks, and castas. This meant that the revolutionaries and royalists in Spanish America had to recruit or persuade non-Europeans. As a result, polemics very much considered their interests and experiences. So let's sum up. The relatively lesser importance of blacks and Indians for patriot revolutionary mobilization meant that Whig theory could concentrate on appealing across lines of class, ethnicity, and religion, while not fully confronting the challenges that caste and racially graded rights posed to the foundational idea of a people. Compared to historical actors in Spanish America, Whigs far less needed to accommodate or struggle against pronounced racial, ethnic, and linguistic divisions, or the corporate demands and rivalries between established Creoles and new immigrants. The fewer and weaker the social fissures that could tear at Whig law and at the Whig notion of the people, the more effective it became at revolutionary mobilization. The Whigs wanted to direct attention from those fissures to the one crucial division they wanted to emphasize, the division between Whig and imperial legal visions. Our Spanish-American comparison brings this into relief. The Spanish-American comparison also helps us see why in the hierarchical and socially differentiated colonial society, the concept of a people could make sense, or at least have fewer strains upon it than in Spanish America. So I've been looking now comparatively, and let's go to Stephen to look downward through society.
What I want to say about the Declaration of Independence is I think that there are really temporally three times that the people appears. The first time it appears is in the passage that we read, which is that the people have certain inalienable rights, and when the power of the monarch or the power of some other party is tyrannical or it's despotic, at that point, that power of the people can appear. But the people are almost in the shadows. They're off stage. They're in the wings up until that point. Then there's a second people that we have, which appears through the Declaration of Independence, which is the people, the polity, what Richard referred to as the polity in the provinces, the assemblies, and the constituted people within their forms of local governance. One of the really striking passages to me in the Declaration of Independence is the grievance that Francis Bernard, the governor of Massachusetts, has moved the location of the Massachusetts Assembly. You know, and he's taking them far away from documents. I don't know why they can't pack up their documents with everything else and keep them with them. But it's really quite striking. I mean, what is he doing? He's moving them from Boston to Cambridge. They're still on the red line, you know, in some kind of distance. And then he moves them to Salem. Well, for goodness sake, that's not very far either. But the assembly was not something to be controlled by the king. It's not something to be controlled by a royal governor. It's something that belongs to that polity where the people embodies a certain set of rights within its locale. And then the third form of the people, which I think is really, really interesting in the Declaration of Independence, is it involves the unitary people, the people from all the different colonies. Suddenly, all of the different colonies are erased. The Declaration of Independence emerges when there is a request from the Assembly in Virginia to create, you know, this kind of document. But we don't have assembly. We don't have it going back to assemblies for ratification. We don't have anything like what we have with constitutional processes where you have constitutive assemblies. What we have here is a sense of the unitary people speaking, as Richard was suggesting, almost as a construct now in this way. And that brings me to how the people take on sovereignty during the revolutionary period. You have to ask yourself, you know, what constitutes sovereignty? And what makes a country sovereign? Well, one is the ability to execute someone, to try someone in a criminal court, and most certainly to hang them or to execute them in some fashion or another, capital punishment. This becomes a commonplace in what I call vernacular legal culture, that is, legalism that takes place in the street. So you have all kinds of, this is an absolute explosion of this material. You not only have effigies, you have mock trials, you have narratives written by criminals who aren't really criminals, they're instead royal officials, but this is all mock, you know, this is all written in their name in some kind of mock fashion. And there's a sense that the control over the criminal justice apparatus now belongs to the people. You have control when you can seize control over the local elements within the province to force courts to act in a certain way through the action of juries, which is something like an assembly, is a gathering of citizens. You have control when you have language that you've now constructed. All of this discussion about rights is just fascinating. Where do these rights come from? We're told they're inalienable, but then they're being constructed as they're being violated. Well, you know, the crown does something like one of those great rights is it doesn't encourage migration. That's a grievance. A good government must encourage migration. So that particular grievance in the Declaration of Independence suggests that there might be some kind of underlying right to expect that of a government, a right to be tried in your own locality when those who are breaking custom laws that are created by the imperial government are sent off to vice admiralty courts far, far away. They've broken a right. Well, we didn't really know we had this right, but now we have this right to be tried in one's vicinage. So the rights are being constructed at this moment. The legal language is being constructed at this moment. Sovereignty is being constructed at this moment. And most important of all, the people are being constructed at this moment.
Fascinating. And I just want to make a quick comment on the immigration point. I don't know if this has any relevance to the legal background, but we learned in a previous episode that the concept of creating more people in the colonies and expanding, the idea of happiness was connected to fecundity or fertility, literally allowing more people to do what they need to do to make the land more fruitful was a concept of happiness. Is that something that you recognize in that passage about immigration?
Absolutely. The republic has to be an expansive republic. And we'll see that when we have the new republic in the early 19th century, that expansion is a fundamental cornerstone of the new republic. I also have to add, this may not be for your recording, but I also have to add, as someone who does intellectual property law, that British artisans who are bringing trade secrets from England to America were a very important part of that migration that Americans really, really wanted. They were involved in knowledge piracy, if you will, and the British attempted to establish limitations on weavers and others who can go with certain amounts of industrial information.
That's fascinating. Maybe I'll have you back to talk about intellectual piracy in the colonies, but we do need to move on here. Richard, why don't you take the story forward, please?
Yeah. So one of the challenges in the American Revolution was how did colonists diverse in religion, ethnicity, occupation, social class, and spread out over 1,000 miles of territory between New England and Georgia get together to advance a revolution? And Stephen and I have been exploring from different angles some answers to this question. And what we want to emphasize is that Whig law had to master space. It had to span geographical space, and it had to master the space between social groups. And it did so in a number of ways. And let me bring together some of the things we've been discussing for the last group of minutes. First of all, Anglicization of law, which I discussed earlier, meant that the convergence of the colonies in their legal practices and ideas created more of a shared constitutional culture that enabled coordination among the different social groups and the different colonies. Secondly, as Stephen was discussing, the use after 1765 of extra-official rituals of rough justice, originally developed in England, furthered what we might call a popular Anglicization of law. The Patriot movement flourished by forging connections between learned, technical Whig constitutionalism and the vernacular culture of the streets. This crossing of social boundaries took place throughout the widely separated colonies. And finally, as the comparison with Spanish America suggests, the colonies were notable for their relatively low levels of corporatism, the absence of competition between recent British immigrants and long-standing white residents, and the modest role of blacks and Indians in the revolutionary armies. This context made more plausible the use of the people as a constitutional construct, one that could overlook racial hierarchies while binding together settlers of different classes, ethnicities, and religions. The concept of the people helped make the Whig legal vision an effective tool of revolutionary mobilization. And so, as we've been trying to make the case for the bulk of this podcast, much, much lies behind the invocation of the people in the Declaration of Independence.
I just want to add a word just to what Richard said, because I really like the way he framed this argument as the transversing of space, the transversing of both cultural space and social space, with these such disparate colonies founded, some like, you know, one by Catholics, one by Quakers, one by uptight Puritans, if you will, one, you know, one by felons, you know, if you go to Georgia, you know, with the colonies are just so disparate. And there's a cultural unity that's being constructed, both high level, with high level law, and this rough justice street law at the bottom. So that's a transversing of space, and then, you know, there was transversing of social space between very, very different social groups. And I want to go back to that problem of Whigs and Tories again, because you could say, well, the Tory answer to Imperium, how do you extend at a time where technologies of communication and transportation are not as powerful as we have today, and the administrative capacities are not as powerful as that we have today, how do you extend this? Well, we'll extend it to the extent that we can through a centralized governance. And the answer that the Whigs have, at least the American Patriots version of the Whigs has, is we will establish our unity by constructing something called the people, and we will do it culturally, and we will do it by constructing this set of legal constructs that will serve as an umbrella of shared values, call them rights, call them what you would like, that will stand in lieu of this very top-down, centralized administrative state of the Tories.
What struck me as interesting in your analysis is, even though, Richard, you had been using the term corporatist to describe the different groups that were influential in a society in Central or South America and Spanish America. What I kept on hearing internally in my head was interest groups. And it struck me that having this legal concept of the people maybe reduces the importance of an interest groups, which because of your status or your, you know, birth, by some circumstance of birth, you would have more power in the society through no other reason. And yet now I start to see, by having this concept of the people, I'm also hearing in that the concept of the person, the individual, and then the concept of individual rights. Am I overreading this, or can we see some sort of flow here in the legal tradition, the Whig legal tradition, that goes against special interests and for individual rights?
Yeah. I'd say at the beginning that, as I understand it, interest groups and corporatist groups are different things. So interest groups exist in democratic societies. You know, farmers may have different interests than merchants, and they try to get their perspectives through the assembly. but they're not corporate groups in the Spanish American sense. You don't have a tribune of the farmers, right? Who is, you know, has a special court for the farmers. You don't have a special jurisdictions, let us say, for blacksmiths or something like that. Interest group politics doesn't, in my view, does not rise to the level of corporatist organization of Spanish America. On your second point, you know, is there some sort of mutually reinforcing nature between political organization done under the aegis of the people and then the notions of the right of the person? I think it could be. I mean, I'm speculating here, but I think it is a logical move from the notion of the people to the importance of each individual person as a rights-bearing person.
Stephen, any thoughts on that?
Yes, I'm wondering. I'm really intrigued by this line of thinking, because I'm wondering, the way we've been talking about this, I'm wondering whether the Declaration of Independence is a document that resolves the problem of empire, not the problem that solves, that leads to the construction of a republic. And that individual rights, as Andy's outlined, in fact, has constructed a way of dealing with people across an expanse of space, that our problem is too much space and too distant from centers of power, and that rights allow us, through individual rights, to be able to vest various individuals with certain rights and to protect those rights through certain legal mechanisms, is a way, actually, to resolve the problem of empire. And maybe, and this is, I don't know if I should say this, but maybe we're actually backing into a republic. We're resolving the problem of empire, but we are backing into a republic.
Accidentally, as it were.
Yes, an accidental republic.
Very funny. Okay, gentlemen, I learned a lot there, but we are reaching the end. So I've been asking all my guests, what are the most important lessons we should be learning from the Declaration of Independence 250 years after its release?
Well, I think I would venture the observation that while the relationship between the people as a analytic construct and the various differentiated social groups within a population is an eternal issue. We wrestle with it today. The specific groups and the specific types of rivalries and hierarchies change, obviously. The structure of American society in 2025 is not that of 1776. But I do think this work of mediation that we put our finger on is still continuing, that politicians and citizens like to speak of the people, full well knowing with one side of their brain that at a certain level doesn't exist and that the United States could in certain ways better be described as contending social groups. And yet it's absolutely essential to our constitutional, social, in certain way, ethical system to invoke the people. And so how you put those two truths together at the same time in your mind is a problem of continuing relevance.
Stephen?
I wonder if we move from the individual life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to that wonderful phrase at the very end of the Declaration of Independence. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. You know, there's a lot of, we've talked a lot about what the Declaration of Independence is. Is it a manifesto? Is it a collection of rights? Is it a set of grievances? Is it a petition? Is it a piece of a public diplomacy hoping to bring the quote-unquote civilized world to the side of the Americans, the patriots? But it's also, in this case, an oath. We are pledging at the end our lives, our fortune, and our sacred honor. And in an age of divisive politics, I can't help to think about what it means to pledge those three things, especially sacred honor. What does it mean to share a common world of truth, a common world of rights, a common world of values? And if the Declaration of Independence is, as Abraham Lincoln has suggested, a document which should be read forward in time as a kind of, almost like a constellation that you can set your ship by and travel through the stormy and turbulent seas of history. If that's true, then, you know, the sacred honor becomes ever, ever, ever more important.
Fine words to end. Professor Richard Ross, Professor Stephen Wilth, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you, Andy.
liberty in the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty in the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty in the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.